welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, Bitcoiners? Hope you all are well all around the world. It's another beautiful morning here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I've got a fun chat with Bitcoin artist Lucho Paletti for you all today. It's a follow-up with artist Brecky Von Bitcoin in last week's episode for a 1-2 punch for my favorite Bitcoin artists. But before we dive in, let's check in on our sponsor, Give Bitcoin. So Give Bitcoin is the easiest, it's the safest, and the best way to gift Bitcoin to your friends and family. It's dead simple. Just go to givebitcoin.io, click on Give, choose how much you want to give and how long you want to time lock the gift for, and boom, your recipient will receive an email asking them to claim the gift. And when they do, they'll receive a world-class Bitcoin education from some of the most experienced Bitcoin educators direct to their inbox once a month for a year. You can also use Give Bitcoin to ask for Bitcoin as a gift. So you can send a link to your family and they can hook you up. And I've got some exciting news for y'all this week. The team that brought you Give Bitcoin has announced that a companion app, Save Bitcoin, will be launching soon. So Save Bitcoin is, again, a dead simple, set it and forget it, dollar cost averaging app for Bitcoin. I think it's the first Bitcoin only DCA app in the United States. So check out Give Bitcoin at givebitcoin.io today and keep an eye out for Save Bitcoin. You can follow save_Bitcoin on Twitter to stay in the loop. I've got one more note to share with you all today before we dive in. You may be listening to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast for the first time on the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. I'm proud to be partnering with LTBN to distribute the pod to their amazing audience. Here, you can expect fun and engaging discussions that draw out unique insights and stories from the best and brightest Bitcoiners in the world. The Citizen Bitcoin Podcast brings an optimistic and excited Bitcoin vibe to your ears every week. I hope to be part of your Bitcoin journey going forward. So thank you to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. Make sure to follow them on Bitcoin Twitter at the LTB Network and subscribe to the LTBN feed for more great Bitcoin content all in one place. All right, let's get on with the show. Lucho Paletti is a Bitcoin artist with an incredibly unique and beautiful style. I've long admired his work and wanted to have him on as a follow-up to my discussion last week with Brecky Von Bitcoin, another great Bitcoin artist. Lucho has an interesting background in business and finance before he followed his passion into a career in art, which eventually merged with another passion in his life, Bitcoin. In this episode, Lucho and I discuss his background story. We delve into our economic situation and the state of global finance. We then move into his art career, his process, and how it has evolved. We discuss a couple of his recent works, and Lucho speculates about how a Bitcoin future might unfold for us. All right, I'm excited to share this one to y'all. Hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Let's dive into this one. I'm very happy to welcome Lucho Paletti to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. How's it going, Lucho?
Pretty good. How are you, Brady? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I'm glad to have you here. Excited to talk to you. I'm doing well. Where are you these days? Whereabouts in the world are you approximately?
I'm in Mexico. I've been in Mexico for almost 2 years now, actually. I'm here and I'll actually be spending some time in Miami for like the next month. The North American Bitcoin Conference is in January. Yeah. So I'm going to be there like a month before that event and stay for the event.
That sounds great. Are you going to be exhibiting some of your art?
Yes. Yes, I will be.
Excellent. That's awesome. Are you going to be at Bitcoin 2020 by chance in San Francisco, late March?
I should be. That process for artists is like they're selecting 21 artists. And I'm not sure actually how many Bitcoin-focused artists there are in the space. Like, you know, if there actually are 21 of them. But I definitely applied for that. So if I'll be exhibiting, I'll be going.
Awesome. Well, I'll see you there then. I'm sure you'll be there amongst the 21. And if not, then I will be talking to some of those organizers to find out what the hell happened there.
Cool.
Because I think you should definitely be there. Yeah. All right. Well, so you said you're going to Miami and I know that you grew up in Miami. Were you into art growing up?
Yes, I was. If I'm going to go back like as far as I possibly can, it was like, I think I was like 2 or 3 years old, started drawing, and my parents, it was just, I mention it because it's the first time that when you have older siblings and you start doing something good and your parents kind of like recognize that like, hey, this one does this thing better than the other older kids, you know? So it was kind of like that. Then my mother started sending me to sketching classes. Painting acrylics from 6 years old, 6, 7, 8, 9, taking classes for that. And then I would compete in school and stuff like that. And eventually as I got older, actually practicing visual arts fell kind of like to the side. I started getting more into music and other hobbies. But eventually as an adult, that's when I really came back to art and basically consider myself a professional artist in the sense that every day I wake up and make art, and that's pretty much my job, you know?
Man, that's amazing. That's a great life. So, I mean, this artist's soul has, I mean, you have an artist's soul, so it's kind of, it's been something that you have been doing from, you know, basically the time that you had enough brain capacity to produce art, which is pretty cool. What kind of stuff did you do like in high school? What were some of your favorite pieces that you did?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of like doing sketches of whatever I was interested in the time. That kind of seems to be the way it was. Like in high school, I liked playing StarCraft a lot. So I don't know if you're familiar with like the old. Yeah, so
I was addicted to it for a while.
Okay. So I would draw like the Protoss, like the different races in StarCraft, stuff like that, video game stuff. And nothing really like anything like what I'm doing now. Back then, I would do portraits. I would paint portraits and landscapes. Like that's what they teach you when you're young, you know? So I did, you know, portraits, landscapes, video game stuff, whatever I liked at the time. And that all changed a lot when I was an adult.
So you had a brief part of your career that was not in art, right? You went to school, college for finance. I'm getting all this, by the way, from the Curating Crypto podcast that I listened to. So I want to shout that out. It's a really great episode. If you want to hear some more about Lucho, check out the episode of Curating Crypto that he did. So you ended up going to finance school, right? You went to college to study business and finance. So how did that happen?
Right. Yeah. So I would say like that boils down to when you crumble into social pressures or whatever, you know, so your parents want what's best for you. Your parents want you to, you know, be secure and have the ability to get out of their homes and pay for your life and all that. So I think there was like a part of that was the reason. The other part was just the culture, you know, speaking of Miami, that's a place where people a lot of times are very focused on social status and material things. Low time preference, right? So like in Miami, it was very much like that. And kind of, it was kind of like a joke almost to consider going school to be an artist, or even like a musician, which was what I was doing at the time that I was entering college. I was playing drums in a band. And I even knew at the time, I was like, you know, none of these guys are going to be like, you know, pro musicians and I'm not going to be a rock star, you know, so I'm just going to go to school and figure it out. So I went to college because that's what people do. They finish school and they go to college. And then as I was going through the motions there, every time you cross like another couple years, you have to declare a major, then you have to finish it. Then another 2 years, you have to, you know, choose what's going to be your specialty if you want to go to graduate school. So I kind of like at each step, I said, well, what should I do? What makes more money? What interests me? And it was like, okay, business. And then it became finance because I was attracted to the concept of financial markets and being able to make investments and make that money work for you, you know? So I thought that was interesting. And that's the reason that I did it. And I did it to the point that I graduated with my master's in finance. And started a CFA designation. And I passed like the first year of 3 years of CFA. And those exams are like super, like they're really challenging, and you basically put your life into it when you're studying it. And at some point, at the same time, I was thinking, like, looking back on 2008, what happened with, like, the whole financial collapse, and yeah. I started getting into conspiracy stuff. So I started getting into, like, you know, the beginner conspiracy that you end up figuring out, it was kind of like all BS, but like you watch Zeitgeist and then you start listening mm-hmm. to David Icke and stuff like that. So this is all stuff that I don't subscribe to anymore, but I do, like, I'm really grateful I did go down that path at that time, because I started really looking at how money is made and looking at how the banking system works and how it's all perpetuated with taking out more debt and putting interest on the people and all that. So that's basically my intro to, like, Austrian economics and also just really hating the banks, you know, which is obviously, like, a big fuel for what I do now.
What exactly did you realize that you hate about the banks? I mean, let's get more specific about, like, what was going on there, because you were part of that world. And I find it fascinating to talk to people who have been in the banking and finance sectors and have, you know, flipped because of Bitcoin or some other reason, and eventually they come to Bitcoin. Can you give us, like, any anecdotes or something that, like, from that transition period where you just were like, this is disgusting. I don't want to do this anymore.
Right. Well, you know, I have to say, like, more than, like, an actual experiencing something in the professional world and being like, this is wrong, It was actually doing that kind of soul searching so recently after I finished the education. So in those classes in university, they teach you, like, you need the Federal Reserve, you need central banking to provide stability. Like, it'll say these things in like terminology definitions in the textbooks, like the central bank is there to provide stability for the economy and control interest rates so you can cool down a heating up, you know, growth cycle mm-hmm. and kind of like start stimulating a recession, and you learn all these things, but it was kind of like that stark contrast between what I read and what I learned for myself, that, you know, the banks weren't actually needed to provide stability. It was like, I guess the conspiracy side will say that, okay, well, the bankers decided to start selling off all the shares, causing, like, all their shares, causing the Great Depression. And then this financial collapse caused people to need stability, right? So it's kind of like it's kind of like manufacturing consent for a Federal Reserve is basically what happened. So it's kind of reading that and realizing how different it was from what I had learned in school. And just the way it works doesn't make sense when you look at it. It's, you know, the private banks create loans, and each time they do this, it's creating more money. And the only way that money is actually seen, I guess, tangibly, is when people pull it out of the economy working for it and pay it back to their debtors. You know, so that system, it's just the fractional reserve system. When you look at it, it's obvious that it's unsustainable. You know, so that kind of was a thing for me, that it made me realize that I don't want to really be part of this banking system at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. I mean, you know, I'm right there with you at this point. And it's only been, you know, a little over 100 years since the Federal Reserve Bank was founded. I think it was 1913. And, you know, we were on the gold standard through most of that time until 1971 and came off. And you're right. It's sort of like a 100-year plan almost. And then this is where the conspiracy stuff comes in. But it's almost, and who knows if it was, you know, intentional or how intentional it was. I'm certain that there was some intention there. Like, you know, there's obvious incentive to control the money to the greatest extent possible. So there's some intention there. How much, like, collusion and, you know, specific planning went on or whatever, who knows? But over 100 years, you know, we had the gold standard rescinded in 1971, and since then it's just, you know, go to what the fuck or WTF happened in 1971.com. Shout out to Colin and Ben for producing that website. You'll just see a ton of graphs that have this inflection point in 1971. And it, you know, it's just the separation of productivity and wages and just on and on, all these economic indicators that, you know, the sound money standard was being strained up till 1971. But, you know, when it was completely blown away, things just, you know, hit the fan. And we're sort of 40, 50 years down the road of this event happening. And who knows, like, how long, how much longer we can kick the can down the road, right? Right. Negative interest rates and all that. You know, and I hear, like, Mark Cuban was on Twitter earlier today or last night, and he was going back and forth with Preston Pysh. And he was talking about, he was like, yeah, well, gold bugs and crypto advocates have been saying that there's going to be this crack up boom forever. It's never happened. When's it going to happen? Right. And I get that point, you know, but the power of the government to just keep kicking the can down the road and literally rob from our, like, productivity, right? Because we've been, we have the strongest economy in the history of the world, and we have incredible innovations and productivity. That is what allows the government to continue to kick the can down the road, right?
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think, like, also there's, like, a globalization aspect to it too, where, you know, a lot of these economies that are really struggling with their fiat currencies, that, you know, they didn't have it so under control. So what's happened, like, just take Argentina, for example. Like, they're dollarizing their economy, like, in a big way. And so when other countries do stuff like that, increasing external demand for the dollars, that kind of, like, keeps the dollar afloat, you know? So yeah. I think that there is, like, a global aspect to it where the dollar can keep doing this as other economies, as other fiat currencies are being destroyed, and they begin adopting the dollar more. Like, just people want to reserve their wealth in dollars, or the banks even want to reserve dollars themselves. And as long as there's that demand, the dollar is not going to collapse just yet.
Right. And, you know, maybe it won't. Maybe Bitcoin will just kind of slowly siphon off demand for the dollar over the next few decades. And we'll have this sort of kind of soft, not as violent or just quick or fast sort of transition. It'll be kind of slow and more peaceful as we transition to a different money, right? And I would say, like, that will be driven by just the truth of hard money, the truth of sound money, that the demand from the free market for the best money possible will end up winning.
Right. Yeah, I think that's definitely the ideal scenario.
Yeah, we don't want to see, like, any major, like, money battles or wars over this. We want to educate and allow this to happen, you know, in a slow, peaceful transition. So yeah, I mean, speaking of the transition, I think a big part of that transition will be aided by art. I think it's really an important part of education. When you moved, so you moved out of the finance career and decided to go become an artist. Can you talk about how that happened, how you made that decision? Like, how did you bootstrap your art career?
Right. So basically, after my first, like, big job in Miami, I decided that, you know, I was going to save some money and start making art. So I actually moved from Miami to Austin, Texas. Just because I wanted to be somewhere where I felt was, like, a better environment for just artists. Like, I could network with other artists there. I could live in a new place and kind of get away from, you know, all the people that I don't know, like, bad influences and stuff in Miami. And so what I did was I basically moved to Austin and I decided I'm going to start doing digital art now because I'm so used to using computers in my life that it almost feels like the keyboard and, like, a laptop is more of a natural extension of me, like, creating than a paintbrush at this point, right? So,
sure. Yeah.
So that was the decision, and kind of also just knowing that technology was moving so fast that I knew that starting with digital art was going to pay off later. So that's basically, I started making art, and it was all, like, I guess I would describe it as an anti-political art. So it was during 2015, 2016, when like the last major election season was ramping up. So when everyone was like really heated up and fired up about the different presidential candidates at the time, I was making like really counter culture art that was kind of just saying like, hey guys, like this is all bad. Like none of this is going to solve the problem. And basically the message behind my art at that point was, you're being controlled mentally by, you know, by the media, and all this propaganda is causing you to think that these issues are important and that these other issues aren't important. So that whole kind of like feel and vibe that still lives on in my art, like to this day, started back then when I first got into digital art. I took a lot of influence from Shepard Fairey, which is the artist behind Obey Giant. Are you familiar with Shepard Fairey?
I am, yeah, mostly because of that Obama poster.
Right. So, yeah. not so much like politically that I agree on things with him, because there's a lot of socialist ideas that he propagates with his art nowadays. But the style and the philosophy that he kind of took with his art project are extremely powerful. And it's the reason why he's one of the most successful, like worldwide known artists, like recognized artists today, is because he used a lot of the same methods that propagandists use throughout history with their war propaganda posters, and, you know, Edward Bernays with his propaganda campaigns for helping with the war efforts, but also for women to start smoking cigarettes because, you know, the cigarettes were a man, it was like a man's thing at some point, and it wasn't considered feminine. So to bolster demand for these private companies, this guy started propaganda campaigns that were really, really effective. Cigarettes, also like the American breakfast comes from this guy's propaganda, you know, like some company needed to sell more bacon and eggs. And they had a lot of pigs sitting around, and they hired Bernays, and he said, hey, let me talk to a doctor. And the doctor said, hey, this stuff is pretty good. So then he starts, hey, doctors recommend a hearty breakfast, and then photos of eggs and bacon and all that. And it becomes culture. You know, that sort of propaganda really becomes culture if it catches on with enough people. So I really took notice of that and started. That's why I would say that I do believe, like, yes, visual art is always like very powerful, but there is something a little bit more to it. Like if you want an exact impact, that's really not left for the viewer to say, oh, I see it this way. And someone else will say, oh, I saw this in it. You know, it's art is subjective in a lot of ways, but when you put your own words into it, you're kind of like dictating that meaning to whoever your viewer is. So I like that a lot, and it made me feel like I could have a much bigger voice than I have verbally with my images.
Yeah, so is that then what you would describe propaganda as? Is the visual art with a very specific viewpoint?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, basically, yeah, propaganda is just any type of media that is supporting a certain cause or movement. So it's a pretty broad term, but in regards to like my application of it, yeah, that's what I'm doing. So I'm doing that with my art. You know, there's currency style pieces, like certificate style pieces that I've made, and there's something about certain images, like propaganda artists in history always use like very bold letters, very basic colors, yellows, reds, blues, whites, and blacks, like things that are high contrast, you know, a very bold message. And it's kind of like, hey, look, this is, you know, if your eyes come across this, I'm going to impart the idea as I intended to who the viewer is.
What are some other examples of successful art or successful propaganda art in history? I assume that there's, you know, obviously social movements, political movements. I would imagine that there's probably some examples of religious propaganda out there as well.
Religious propaganda. You know, I don't have like any examples off the top of my head. So,
I mean, would we consider like Renaissance artists who are hired by the Vatican to produce, let's just say like Michelangelo, you know, in the Sistine Chapel, would you consider that to be propaganda art? Because it's obviously promoting a specific cause or movement and has a very specific point of view in terms of like how things happened or how things should be.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that mostly all of that commissioned art from even those Renaissance times was a form of propaganda. Even, you know, a lot of the sculptures and paintings were to glorify the masters, you know, to glorify the rulers. And yeah, it made them shine brighter and it made people more likely to continue submitting. So to your point, I'd definitely say that was a form of propaganda.
So what's interesting is that, you know, Bitcoin doesn't have any leaders or masters. It's that's what's amazing about it. It's a decentralized protocol and it's open source, and even the art and marketing and education that surrounds it is all decentralized and just organic. There's no central, you know, marketing or creative department. So how does propaganda fit into this more decentralized model from, you know, its sort of history of really being used to promote one specific idea and those people that the masters, like you said, the Soviet propaganda and German Nazi propaganda were all promoting leader figures.
Right. So, I mean, my take, like, and if you've seen my body of work, focuses a lot on like different depictions of Satoshi.
Yeah.
And I think like, I mean, it really the fact that Satoshi was an anonymous character really leaves like a lot for the creative to kind of run with. So I can use my, I can use my imagination and say, hey, let me depict Satoshi like this time or another way, another time, just to kind of see what gets people's attention and say different things, you know? So I could depict Satoshi as like a Thomas Jefferson or as, you know, an old president, or even as, you know, someone who might not been that great of a great of a leader, but maybe had something good to say at some point, and just kind of like reimage that and use it to communicate something new. So something to kind of say, hey, you know, like in history, these guys messed up and these guys did a lot of bad things, but, you know, there were problems in those days that we still have today. And now we have Bitcoin, which is, you know, like I consider Bitcoin like very much a political movement, right? Because, you know, it has the power of, you know, with the community behind it to basically make the old system, the old financial system obsolete, right? So, right. So you do basically have like this father of this movement that had all of his philosophy, you know, kind of written partially like it was written in the code, and then, you know, he left a lot of quotes behind that I don't think it's gospel what Satoshi said, you know, but I think there's a lot of sound principles there that you can use this type of imagery to communicate.
There's a book called The Book of Satoshi that I think is not as well known as I think it should be. It's one of my favorites, and it's literally just all of the publicly published words of Satoshi. So it starts with the white paper, and then just goes through all of the forum postings. And there's even some private emails that were exchanged between Satoshi and early Bitcoiners that were contributed and given to the author of the book to print. And it's a fascinating lens on the early process, the first couple of years of Bitcoin. So I definitely suggest people checking that out for sure. And it really does give you a sense of who Satoshi was. Certainly not, like you said, this book is not a gospel, and certainly not like a person that we should hold up as an icon in Bitcoin. I think that's antithetical to the principles and ideals of Bitcoin. I don't think Satoshi would want that at all. But I think the idea of Satoshi, right, as you're using it in your art is very useful and does make sense because it's sort of this empty vessel, right? And the artist, like you said, can imprint their own take or vision on the idea of Satoshi.
Right. Totally agree.
All right. So at what point in this whole timeline did you get into crypto and Bitcoin? Was it when you were getting into art, or I think you said it was before when you were still in the finance career path?
Right. So after I started getting into digital art, I was trying to do it full time. But the problem was when you learn something and you're trying to make a living off that thing, like before you're really great at it or good at it, it's very difficult. I mean, it's always difficult, you know, entrepreneurship in general. But basically, I ran out of like runway with that first project. So I went back to the finance world. I took another job. And as I was working that job, I came across Bitcoin. And I'd come across it as far back as like 2012, just from the speculation and someone asking me, what do you think about Bitcoin? That type of thing. And seeing like, you know, the references of like what the price was back then. You know, maybe 25 cents the first time I looked at it, and then not really thinking much of it, thinking, oh, bubble, whatever. And then coming back to it, I believe this was like early 2016 when the prices were around like $600. That was 2016, right? $600 Bitcoin.
Yeah, sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. So
early 2016.
Yeah. So I started looking at it again then, and then that's when I decided to actually try to figure out what it was all about, you know? So that was like my rabbit hole experience, but more attracted to Bitcoin at that point, purely speculative reasons. Like, hey, why is this thing worth so much? And is it going to keep going up or not? Right. So right. I have no shame saying that that's how I got in. That's not, you know, why I'm here now, obviously, but that's definitely like what attracted me was the speculative side of it. So I started looking at it and reading more into it, and then realizing that, you know, the technology was actually something that could supplant the banking system, you know, very far away from doing it at that point and still maybe today. But just realizing that, hey, this is actually it's a payment system, like it's a decentralized payment system. And I can use it to send money. People can send money to me. Oh, wow. That's like, it's more than just a speculative. It's more than just like a different version of like a small cap stock or something, you know, because right. I think a lot of people did see it that way or still do to this day. But that's how I got attracted to it. And then reading more about it, learning more about it, beginning to invest, beginning to save some of my income in Bitcoin, bull market of 2017 started hitting. And then anyone who was involved at that point got super excited, right? So I think I was like, man, Bitcoin, you know, like this crypto thing, I'm going to quit my job. Like I'm going to, you know, so I started very quickly thinking like, hey, could this give me the opportunity to do what I wanted to do before? So I basically, I worked a couple years, and at the end of like the bull market, I felt so financially secure at that point that I would just bail on my job and start the art project again. So that's exactly what I did. So I quit my job and I decided, all right, I'm going to fire up this computer and I'm going to start creating art, but now my art's going to be about Bitcoin. Because this is how I felt too, coming out of like my first kind of like go at creating art, sharing it, getting the feedback, you know, I realized then like that's something very, very special to me. Like being able to create, share with the world, get that feedback, and kind of like use that as a loop to keep creating and making better things or things that are hopefully going to impact people more. I realized that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And then I also realized that when all I have to share with people are what's wrong in the world, and what's the problem, you know, and pointing it out, there's something about doing that that's like a huge drain on you as a like on me as a creator. And also, like, I don't know, I just, it's like you're literally putting out negativity. Part of it is like you're sounding the alarm to wake people up, but the other part of it is like, well, I'm just really just telling people what's wrong. You know, I didn't have a solution. So it's kind of like when you hear, like, I had this boss that used to say to me, like, yeah, don't come here with like just problems, just like already try to make your solution. When you're going to share the problem, have the solution ready, you know? So like, yeah, that's just an anecdote, but it's very true that like people don't want to hear problems as much as they want to hear solutions. And if you're going to present the problem, it's much better to present a solution with it. So that's kind of like the big connection that I had from like, where was my life experience, like when I started creating art, and then this project where I'm only making Bitcoin art is basically always like, I have the solution, here it is, look at it, and how, right, here's how it relates to all the problems that you have. Because my art also is basically, I have like the pre-coiner in mind when I'm creating. The vast majority of my art is all audience intended, is someone who doesn't understand Bitcoin. So there are some arts that, you know, you kind of have to understand a little bit more what Bitcoin's all about to kind of get it. But mostly my art is intended for people who don't know what Bitcoin's all about.
Yeah. And I like that about your art, because you also, it's definitely consumable by people who don't know what's, you know, going on, and it's a good introduction into Bitcoin and maybe a nice little tease of an invitation to come down the rabbit hole, you know, and like, let me check this thing out. But your art is also really intricate and has these details in there that are really just inside information or inside communication between you and a Bitcoiner that only a Bitcoiner would really understand.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, that's basically what it is. I mean, it's, there's two parts of it too, because one part of it is also like, I live off this, right? So I sell prints, I sell digital art, and I do literally live off the art that I make on my computer. So part of it is like, I do have a community that supports me, and I do want to kind of like let them know that I'm communicating a message for them. But I do try to build that into the image like a little bit more subtly, so that it's still like something that a pre-coiner would understand, or even just like be able to look at and read and not be like, what is this all about?
Yeah. And you've been translating your art, your print art, and, you know, your illustrator stuff that you're doing into a more memeified representation of that art. Can you talk about your experience, like producing, let's talk about like the Instagram AR filters with the Satoshi mask, or like the GIFs that you've been making on Twitter? You just dropped a really cool one right before we started recording. Can you talk about, you know, your experience there and what you've learned about memes that work on Twitter and on the internet?
Yeah, sure. These are kind of like newer things that I'm expanding into lately. Two things here. One is that just social media in general is really kind of, it's leaning towards video more and more and more nowadays. So where my images like in 2015 might have gotten a lot more interaction on like an Instagram, for example, a video now is going to be getting more engagement. It just seems like that's the way it is. So someone who creates only static art that is intended for prints and stickers and posters, I felt a need to kind of like up my game to start creating a little bit more video friendly stuff. So like you have TikTok now is like a big thing. Instagram stories and all those algorithms are favoring whoever, like whatever is longer duration. So if the eyeball stays on an image for 30 seconds, wow, that's amazing, but it probably won't. And then if the video actually is 30 seconds, it's a lot more likely that someone's gonna view that. So that's like one aspect is strategic, I guess, of it. And the other aspect is just that you can say more in a moving image than you can say in a static image a lot of the time. So I think that like memifying it, adding, you know, more movement to it, adding more images and you know, being able to put multiple different images and move throughout it in one piece is something that I find it interesting. It's like, it's almost like you make like a really, really tiny, tiny film, you know, it's like a really small thing. But it's something that, I don't know. I mean, I enjoy it a lot, but I think that there is something to it that it could connect with more people. Also the AR filters, the Satoshi mask is like, something that I thought, you know, I use this mask a lot. It's like a staple in my artwork. And it'd be really cool now that Instagram opened up like that platform to let people put AR on it. I thought it was really cool. And you know, like those filters are getting like, you know, they're getting like tens of thousands of engagements. And like I get these updates that it's like, hey, your other mask just hit the 10K thing today. And I'm like, oh, wow.
That's awesome.
So that means that like 10,000 people interacted with a mask that clearly has a Bitcoin logo on it. You know, so
right.
I think that and the viral effect that gets, it's like, in this case, it's just something that one person puts a mask on, puts it on their Instagram, another person does it, and it creates a viral effect that doesn't create like that much benefit for me personally, because it's on their own Instagram pages. But I know that that image is getting to a lot more people, and a lot more people are saying, why is there like a Bitcoin symbol on this, on this anonymous mask, is what people basically say. So my mask like has my own, like it's derived from the Guy Fawkes mask, but it does have my own artwork. But that's what everyone thinks when they say it. Why does the Guy Fawkes mask have a Bitcoin logo? And then what I hope is that leads more people to go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, so you think the relationship between the Guy Fawkes inspired mask that you use and Bitcoin is that the anonymity of Satoshi? Is that why you use that mask to represent Satoshi so much?
Yeah, that's why. I mean, because it's still to this day an anonymous figure, according to most of us, right?
So, right.
So, I think so. Yeah, I mean, it's a combination between an already iconic mask and just like it's almost a reappropriation for Bitcoin. Yeah. And I think that it's effective.
It's definitely very fitting, I think, too. I wanted to ask you, I'm looking at this dancing Satoshi GIF that you made.
Okay.
And this one definitely struck me when you first posted it. And I just think it's amazing. Can we talk about some of the references in here? Because there's so much going on in it. There's obviously the rocket ship. And like we all get that, what's going on there. But yeah, can you take us from the Satoshi has many arms, there's these snake-like things coming out of the hair, and then there's the Satoshi mask that you've just described, and then we have the brink, or, well, there's something that Satoshi's standing on too that I don't even, what is that? Is that like a pig or something? It's being sacrificed or what? Like what is
Yeah. So I do want to, like, I could point you to the original artwork that I created that I derived the GIF from to give like a bigger picture of like the whole thing, which it's like a banknote style artwork that I called it Creation and Destruction. And what it does is it actually has this one character on one side of it, which is the dancing Satoshi is derived from the Shiva, the destroyer. And then you also have Brahma, the creator, on the other side of the note. So it's kind of showing like a duality between Satoshi, the creator, you know, like, so you have Bitcoin's creation and the principles that were behind that of, you know, security, decentralization, censorship resistance, and all that. And then you have the destroyer aspect, which is what you're asking me about. Which basically, in the original the dancing Shiva is the name of the original image that the Hindus use, and it's an amazing image because like the amount of meaning that they put into that image would really like blow a lot of people's minds if they read into it from how the hair is reaching out into like all the universe. And meaning like that the god has, that god Shiva has, you know, access to all of it. And the way that he's stepping on the back of his of the ego, which is like what I use as like the banker, which if you look really close in that image is actually has like a international IMF logo on it. So what it's almost meme-ish, but it also looks kind of serious in the other art piece. So in the other one, the original has like all of the fiat currencies around the frame. So saying like that, the tentacles that are coming out of Satoshi's head in this case is like touching all of them. And then that he's stepping on the back of the bankers, and then the flames that come from the rocket ship are burning up all the fiat, and in the same event, takes off. Right. So I think that, you know, it's pretty meme-ish, you know, that GIF, but also there's like a deeper meaning behind it.
Yeah. I mean, it's pulling from so many different memes, from all the way back to like ancient Hindu memes, religious memes, and a bunch of Bitcoin memes. And then, yeah, the idea of Satoshi, the destroyer of this fiat regime and the creator of this Bitcoin Renaissance that we're at the dawn of right now. And then it zooms in, at the end on the inscription of the Genesis block, Chancellor on the brink of the second bailout of banks. And then it just sort of fades into this very dense network that looks like, you know, the Bitcoin represents the Bitcoin network or the Lightning network.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I love it. So how do you see the future of Bitcoin art and propaganda developing? It's kind of a nascent field right now, but how do you imagine it developing in the future when Bitcoin is becoming, well, I should say like the world is becoming much more aware of what's going on here.
Right. So I think that Bitcoin art will stay like, all right, let's talk about crypto art in general for a quick second. So okay. Because this needs to be talked about, right? So because I consider myself to be very maximalist about Bitcoin. So if you notice that all my art focuses only on Bitcoin and yeah. It doesn't focus on promoting like any of the other projects whatsoever. So I'll say that. But there is like a movement that's happening in crypto art that's very like only digital based that unfortunately just the way it is right now, and I have to say it, is that this thing is happening on Ethereum. Why is it happening on Ethereum? I'm not sure exactly. Maybe they moved a little bit more quickly to make like ecosystems, but there is like a non-fungible token thing that's actually taking off like pretty well now. So I think that's very encouraging, like for me, someone who's in the space and just seeing what's happening there. But it hurts a lot as well, because like I've been for a very long time, like saying like, hey guys, like where's the NFT thing happening on Bitcoin, and who can get this thing spun up so I can just go and like start promoting it and start tokenizing my art there. Not a lot's happening on Bitcoin now. So that's happening primarily on Ethereum. But I'll tell you, like, I'll be the first one to start moving over to tokenizing my stuff on Bitcoin, just because I'd rather not have like my reputation attached so much to Ethereum when I don't really care for it. And I'm more about Bitcoin, right? So there is, but the thing to kind of note is that crypto art is taking off there. And people are spending thousands of dollars equivalent in their Ethereum to buy tokenized digital art. That's not even like, it's not a physical product. It is tokenized on that blockchain. So for one, I think it's like just the proof of concept is there, and like it's succeeding right now. So it's super encouraging. And I would encourage like anyone who's interested in building on the Bitcoin side, like, seriously, start doing it. And like, you have artists like myself who are more than happy to help promote a Bitcoin version of what's going on the Ethereum side. So that like current state, that's what's happening right now. Like, you can see clearly adoption of non-fungible tokens for art is happening. And furthermore, like the values of these tokens are appreciating like faster than the underlying asset, right? So that's happening right now. And then in the future, I think that like, as this art movement is still very young, like the Bitcoin art thing, is that people, it's very much like, I could almost say it's like icon worship a lot. Like a lot of the artists are emphasizing very much like the Bitcoin logo and making like cool artwork around it. But I think that that's going to grow up. That's going to mature a bit too. Like the artists themselves are going to iterate enough to where like their ideas are more well developed and they're able to communicate something like a little more, I don't know if mature is the word, or maybe just more complex, like visually and conceptually, right? So it's a thing where like it's a challenge for an artist who, like, a lot of times artists do like a wide range of topics, and a lot of the artists like I'll just speak on the behalf of someone like Brecky, right? So Brecky mm-hmm. von Bitcoin is only doing Bitcoin art, which he does a very good job. Myself as well, I only do Bitcoin art. It is a challenge at times to, like, you're iterating over and over again on the same thing. So you're forcing yourself, you're pushing yourself to take the ideas further. So I think that mm-hmm. there's like people like Brecky, there's people like, I don't know, like Pascal Boyart, you have like Trevor Jones, like some of the artists are beginning to take the ideas like a little bit further. And I think like it's going to be the combination between like the artists in the space taking their ideas further to communicate like something more and more powerful, along with adoption of Bitcoin and like the market to expand. I feel like those two things are going to happen together in this next cycle, I guess, bull cycle. And with that, there's going to be recognition from the traditional art world. There's even like Trevor Jones. I don't know if you've heard of Trevor Jones, but he's a painter that's classically trained. And he started literally interrupting the traditional art world, putting like augmented reality Bitcoin art on top of other artists' work that he was exhibiting with. So like he took that and basically is saying like, hey, we're about to do this to you, and like here's a glimpse. So he did this like a couple of years ago now, right? So I think I like to use that example a lot, because it's almost like an analogy or almost like a foreshadowing of like what I think is going to happen, is that, you know, crypto art or Bitcoin art is not exactly going to take over the art world overnight. But I feel very strongly that this is an art movement that you're not going to be able to ignore. It's like Bitcoin art is a thing, and there's a lot of people very passionate about it, creating really cool stuff. So I see the digital ecosystems taking off next, like along with the market, and like as that really expands, I do see the traditional art world stepping in, not only to begin displaying and exhibiting Bitcoin art alongside whatever contemporary art is going on, but also adopting potentially blockchain solutions for their galleries.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, and I think that vision really helps solidify how important art is to a movement like this. And it works, it's kind of like two sides to the coin, right? Because it starts with inspiring so many artists to start working on producing Bitcoin art. And that, what we talk about when we talk about Bitcoin marketing, and I talked about this with Brecky too, the thing that's so special about Bitcoin marketing, and the reason it works so well, is that there's some fundamental truth behind it, right? There's this very inspiring truth. And the fact that it's inspiring very talented artists, professional artists, to start devoting at least some of their work to Bitcoin is amazing. And that viral loop will continue. And art is particularly great at producing these viral loops and then in turn inspiring people as well. So I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned. You were talking about these non-fungible tokens, NFTs. What is their purpose in art? I've kind of seen people talk about them or heard people talk about them a little bit, but I don't understand exactly how they're being used or why they are useful, I guess.
Right. So this is a conversation I've had like with a couple people where I find it like, it's kind of ironic, but then it's like, I totally understand like the way that people either, I don't know if misunderstand it or they just kind of like don't get it, right? So I think like the analogy is basically, for me, is like, well, you have digital assets, like people already are able to grasp the concept of digital money, right? So you have, you have a limited supply, you have scarcity that's provable, and then that lives. And because it's scarce and because it's secure, then it can have a value according to that. Just very super fundamental basic, right? Right. So art can be the same way, but I guess it's more about where did that art come from? Like, it needs to be provable that it was from the original artist. And as long as that's the case, and the artist says, here's my edition, it's a one of one, or it's a one of 10, one of 21, whatever it is. Here's the edition. And the only way to own it is if you purchase this non-fungible token, and then you can be potentially, like if it's a one of one, for example, which the way that I'm leaning towards more for digital art is selling one of ones, so that it becomes like super special if someone owns the only digital copy. And then no matter if that file is being shared around the world, you know, people are saving the image down to their machine or whatever, there's one person who bought. It's like part of it is patronage. Like you can be that one collector that said, hey, I'm the only person who owns this piece. And part of it is just digital scarcity. Like it's digital art. What I create is mostly all digital art, right? So so my original is actually a digital, and then I'm printing copies and selling them as limited editions. So yes, these are limited editions. I'm not going to inflate it and create funny money prints. But the digital is like the actual, the medium, like it's the actual original of the artwork. So I think that, okay, so easy enough to understand. You have a token that says that this is the only token and someone can purchase it and they can own it in their own crypto wallet, right? So there's that. But then I guess the other aspect is like, what are people going to do with that, right? So in the NFT world, like, which is something that you kind of go down like this other rabbit hole and you start, what are people doing with this? There's like virtual reality worlds. Like there's one named Crypto Voxels is an example. So people have full art galleries in there with full like multimedia experiences. So you have like this little avatar, you go into this little world and people are building like galleries and building whatever they want in there. So they have like their own little, it's almost like a Second Life world in there. And people are taking NFTs and they're displaying them in there, for example. So like, that's one thing that people are doing with their NFTs. But besides from that, like immediate, like, oh, there's some ecosystems that allow people to put the NFTs and display them, is basically, it's the ownership of like the limited digital asset. So, like I was saying before, I have my art. It's taking myself as an example. Like I'm a person who creates these digital assets on my computer, and they literally are like my lifeblood. Like I use them to build my own brand on social media, and I use them to sell as prints. And if someone gets a hold of like my high resolution file, I'm screwed, right? Like that's a digital asset that's very, very special to me. So that's another thing, like with these NFTs, like I'm making a lot of animations because I think they work really cool for like non-fungible tokens, and like people aren't actually able to run away with like my vector art that can be blown up as big as, like if someone wants a print to cover their house with, they can do that with one of my high resolution files. But if someone has a copy of that, I'm in a bad spot because I won't be able to monetize it the same.
Right. So, but then that's why the NFTs are useful, because then you can say, a collector could say, this is the one that's valuable because I bought it from the artist directly.
Right.
And not just got it off the internet somewhere, right? That makes sense. So I'm surprised that there's not some solutions based on Bitcoin for this. Could you not anchor some sort of identifier in a Bitcoin transaction and then have the person who holds that UTXO be the holder of that particular piece of art that corresponds to that identifier? Or there's also another potential is RGB tokens on Lightning, which is something that you could take a look at. I don't think there's anything well developed there yet, but it's something that would be possible.
Yeah, so I think that probably the research that I've done shows that, yes, you can tokenize something using Bitcoin. Like, you can tokenize art using Bitcoin. Now, the problem is that there is no ecosystem for it. So for me, to participate, I'm gonna there needs to be a market for me to participate. Now, what I do use Bitcoin for are all my limited edition prints are actually timestamped on the Bitcoin chain, and I send collectors a certificate that's stamped there, and you can verify it, right? So I do that for my physical prints, but as far as NFTs go, I think that the real thing to build or the real thing to use is an ecosystem where you have buyers and sellers. It's almost like a community, right? Like, you have artists that are going to submit their artwork and tokenize them and, display them somewhere where, there's more than just one artist, ideally. And then collectors can also go to the same place and find that. I think that, to your point, Lightning development is underway, and I think that NFTs, I would be surprised if we're sitting here having the same discussion in March or April. I think that by that point, probably there should be a solution that at least people can point to and say, hey, look, you can definitely use this, and people can start building with this. On Lightning, but I don't think it's there yet.
No, it's not there yet. There's definitely the potential for it. And I think Liquid would be another potential. You can issue tokens on Liquid and create a market there for NFTs too, where people could trade them back and forth. But I think long-term, building on Lightning would be a much, much preferred solution, because that ecosystem is just going to be so huge. And it's already just grown absolutely crazy. So have you used Lightning to sell any of your work from your website, like your sticker packs or the watches or anything else that you sell there?
Yeah, definitely. Lately, there's been more and more Lightning people purchasing with Lightning. But I've been accepting Lightning payments for maybe 6 months now on my website. And yeah, a good number of them are. It seems like a lot of people still pay with fiat, a lot of people still check out with PayPal, but I have to say that Bitcoin is probably I don't even remember the last time I received another currency on my site, probably only Bitcoin mostly that I've received for payment. And then Lightning seems to be, people are using Lightning more than traditional Bitcoin lately on my site as well. So that's really encouraging as well.
Yeah, it's the payments network, and it's definitely working. I've been using Lightning more and more to buy things online and whenever I can, and just refilling with Cash App, just mainly because I want to support the network in its early days and just be an early adopter and user and experience it so that I can file bug reports and talk about UX improvements and things like that. And I've been using it from the very beginning. Basically, I bought a Blockstream sticker in the early days when you had to, command line set up your node and all that stuff. And so I managed to get my Blockstream sticker as sort of a badge of early Lightning honor. And then since then, it has just gotten so much better, so much better, so quickly. When I think when the first wallets came out, and then when the Sats app came out on Casa, even that, which wasn't even that long ago, there were still errors, routing failures every 3-4 transaction attempts, you know, so it was quite often. Now, just in the past couple of months with like LND version 0.8, I mean, huge strides, and I haven't had a payment failure. Even with making relatively large purchases of $50, $60, $70 in a couple months. So it's amazing how fast it's growing.
So is that's an improvement that's rolled in like the last couple of months, huh?
Yeah, the version 0.8 of LND had a lot of major improvements to routing discovery. One of the problems I think that I heard was that you could search for a route to confirm that there was a route before the actual transaction was executed. So you'd come back to the wallet and be like, yep, we got a route, so let's go ahead and execute it. And then you'd go to execute on that route and it like couldn't find that route again, or that route didn't exist for some reason. So it was like this very confusing process for wallet builders. And so just the anecdotal evidence or anecdotal stories I've heard from Lightning developers that latest release has made routing far better. And that's been my experience too, as a, you know, trying to pay over the network.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, I'm not a very technical person at all. But I have been accepting Lightning payments on my website so Shopify is like the platform I use for my website, right? Like a lot of people use that for e-commerce. And yeah, what you use are like plug and play gateways for payments, right? Well, that's what I use. That's what most people use. So I do use one named Globee.com. And it was having issues like a few months ago. Sometimes when the Lightning payments were coming in, like they would get declined. So that's something that I had problems a few months ago. And last couple of months, I've been getting Lightning purchases with no problems.
Yeah. It's growing up. It's only a year and a half old. Well, I guess coming up on 2 years old, although I think all of the protocol developers were like, no, do not use mainnet yet. Just use testnet. That's where the hashtag reckless came from. So yeah, I think we're at almost 2 years now, not even 2 years yet. And it's just come so far. I think 2020, 2021 are going to be just bonkers in terms of Lightning development.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really hope to see some good apps. And especially if Bitcoin art starts happening on Lightning, I will be like super, super happy. I'll probably be the happiest person of all. So,
all right, there it is. There's an idea out there for all of the developers who are listening. Get a little crew together and hack something together for Lucho, and he'll be your first alpha tester.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, man, this has been a super fun conversation. Really appreciate what you're doing out there. It's incredible work. I think it's really important work, and you're sort of on the front lines, really leading the charge in this new emerging field of Bitcoin art. Congrats on that and everything that you're doing, man.
Cool, man. Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed the chat as well. And I think Citizen Bitcoin has got a lot of good info for, you know, for Bitcoiners. But I think it's really great. Like, I'm going to start sharing this podcast with a lot of people, too, because I think you're doing a great job here.
I really appreciate that, man. All right. I will hope to see you out in San Francisco and buy you a beer and check out all of your art in the real world, in physical meat space. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, cool. All right, Brady. Good talking.
Take care, man.
Okay.
All right, that was a good time as always. Like I say, there's nothing better than talking Bitcoin with Bitcoiners. Hope you all enjoyed listening to that one. Thank you, Lucho, for your time. I hope you all will let us know your thoughts and questions about the episode. Let us know on Bitcoin Twitter. Lucho is at Lucho Paletti. That's at LUCHOPOLETTI. And I am at Citizen Bitcoin. You can support the podcast by sharing it on Bitcoin Twitter and with your family and friends. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. Love to hear from you all. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram and Keybase. And my email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. This week's open source shoutout is Ride the Lightning. RTL is a web-based interface to help manage Lightning node operations. RTL works with both the LND and C-Lightning implementations of the Bolt spec. Ride the Lightning comes pre-installed on all Nautil nodes, for instance, as the primary interface to manage your Lightning node. You can help support the RTL project by running the software, providing issue reports on the RTL GitHub, and by helping with documentation. Of course, also coding. Keep an ear out for next week's holiday gift from me to you, a drop with the OG Bitcoin educator himself, Andreas Antonopoulos. Really excited for that one. Honored to have him on the show. Then, just before New Year's Eve, expect a year in review basement bulletin episode with my buddies Tom Pearson and Guy Swan. We'll start the new year with drops from a couple Bitcoin authors, Jan Pritzker, author of Inventing Bitcoin, and Kiara Bickers, author of the new book Bitcoin Clarity, will be joining me on the podcast. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.